History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And what we hope to demonstrate is that they don't have to go untold, as long as somebody's willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions, and then be patient enough to listen as memories that may not have seen the light of day for decades emerge from the shadows again. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often, don't we? We end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We all know this is Father's Day weekend, a special time for all of you who still have your father here on earth to celebrate, but also a reminder for those of us whose fathers have passed. For some of you, this will be your first Father's Day since your dad passed away, and that applies in the case of so many amazing World War II veterans you've gotten to meet here on the radio who have finished their journey on Earth since last Father's Day. While we've met some amazing female veterans on Hometown Heroes over the years, the overwhelming majority of vets we get to talk to are men, and the vast majority of those men are fathers themselves. So many have shared powerful memories relating to their own fathers. We couldn't possibly have time to explore all those moments today, but we are going to try to attach a Father's Day theme this weekend as we look through the eyes of our veterans at that special relationship between father and child. We've heard many a veteran tell that story of not being able to be present for a child's birth because he was fighting overseas and didn't meet his son or daughter till he got home, sometimes years later. We've heard from veterans who became Gold Star fathers when their sons were killed in Vietnam. We've heard some of the tender moments from farewells and reunions. And one story that sticks out for me comes from Navy veteran Grant Erickson, the 10th of 11 children in his family and one of five brothers serving in World War II. He received frequent letters from his mother during his time on the battleship USS New Mexico, surviving multiple kamikaze attacks, including one that killed his captain 6 feet away. But only one letter ever came from Grant's father, and boy, did it mean a lot.
Well, it really did, because I think being the 10th born in a family of 11, we were never that close.
Sure.
I always kind of had the feeling that I could never quite satisfy my dad, you know, although he was always there when he needed to be there, you know. Mm-hmm. And I knew that he loved me, but that was quite a letter.
I don't know if this is asking my much too much, but you think you could try to read it for us?
Oh, I probably could. Would you like me to read? Okay. I wish I had the power to write the thoughts wedged in my heart tonight. As I sit watching that small star and wondering how and where you are. You know, son, it's a funny thing how close a war can always bring a family who for years with pride have kept emotion deep inside. I'm sorry that when you were small, I let reserve build up that wall. I told you real men never cried. And it was moms who always dried your tears and smoothed the hurt away so you couldn't go back to play. But son, deep down within my heart, I long to have some little part in drying that small tear-stained face. But we were men. Men don't embrace. Now suddenly I find my son a full-grown man with childhood done. Tonight you're far across the sea and waging war for men like me. Well, somehow pride and what is right just do not seem to go tonight. I find my eyes won't stay quite dry. I find that sometimes men do cry. And if we stood here face to face, I fear we'd find men do embrace. Son, dads are quite a funny lot. And if I've failed you in some spot, it's not because I love you less. It's just that thing called manliness. But if I had the power to write the thoughts wedged in my heart tonight, the words would ring out loud and true. I'm proud, my boy, so proud of you. I got through it.
You did. Where were you when you got that letter?
That was after our ship was hit, actually, in January. Sometime between that time and the time we were in Okinawa, they hit the second time.
And your father is expressing things there that he had never expressed before. And he's sharing with you that his eyes aren't dry. I bet yours weren't either when you read it.
They weren't, really. Yeah, I'm not the crying type, but yeah, the tears came, yeah.
Especially on that last line, I bet.
Yeah.
I'm proud, my boy, so proud of you.
Surely many other sons received similar sentiments during World War II, memories that would guide them as fathers later on. And if you were to listen to Grant Erickson's complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com, you would hear several mentions of the USS Indianapolis, a cruiser that operated in close proximity to the battleship New Mexico. By now, most of us are familiar with the Indianapolis and its tragic fate. There are books, there are movies, but in 2022, very few survivors. As of today, there are only two men still with us who survived the sinking of the Indianapolis in July 1945, shortly after the ship had delivered components of the atomic bomb to Tinian. One of those two survivors, Harold Bray, just celebrated his 95th birthday this week in California's East Bay. Now he'll get to have a happy Father's Day as well. Harold's father had served in the British Army in World War I, and Harold convinced him to sign for him to enlist in the Navy. The teenager went straight from boot camp to the cruiser Indianapolis, but in the early morning hours of July 30th, 1945, he was not sleeping in his normal bunk on the third deck down.
Well, it was called hot bunk, you know, when you got out, another guy got in.
Yeah.
Yeah, so 1,100 or 1,200 guys on that boat. It was a little overkill because, well, during the war, you just were there to replace somebody that got hit or something.
Typically, you would sleep below deck, but because it was so hot, they told you you can sleep topside?
Yeah, that's where I slept on number two turret. I took a sleeping bag and a pillow, and I put it on top of the turret. And I remember it right. I took my shoes off and my clothes on. A little after midnight, we got hit. And when the torpedoes hit right on the opposite side of the ship of me, and it rolled me off with that, I was like a 10-foot drop. I seen my shoes go over the side, and I was dressed with dungarees on, and I was sleeping on the open like that. And I got down on the quarter deck, and it was just amazing. It seemed like we carried like 87 Marines. It seemed like they were all right there on the quarter deck when I got down there. They start to bail off. We were still on our way. I never got in the water till she was on her side. I was forward of the quarter deck. I got down on the quarter deck. And guys were going nuts or running all over the place. Some guys were hit. Some guys were bleeding. I stopped at the quarterdeck just to get my bearings, and my shop was at the Fantail. I was a ship fitter. So I made my way back to, I went through the hangar deck, and I grabbed some kind of tools, and I headed back to the Fantail. On the way back, I grabbed a life jacket. The guy was throwing them out of the pocket, and I got back to the Fantail, and there were three guys laying up against the bulkhead. One guy was bleeding pretty bad, and I gave him my life jacket. I helped him up to the lifeline. I made sure that he jumped off right forward of the propellers. We got him over the side. She was laying on her side in the water. I went back and got another one, and all that time, she was keeling over, and by the time I got back to the Fantail, she was on her side, and instead of floating off, I climbed over the rail and ran down the side of the ship to the quarter deck instead of floating off. I was going to stay dry as long as I could. When I went over the rail, I had to run forward to get away from the shafts. Screws were still turning. So I ran to the quarter deck, and that's where most of the guys were piling off there. They're all gathered there, but she was going down fast. And so I got in the water. And when I hit the water, somebody hit me and drove me down. I opened my eyes up in the water to see the guys, the lights. And, of course, stupid me opened my eyes in the salt water. That was not the thing to do. When I come to the surface, I looked back, and she was up on her bow. She was halfway sunk already. Guys were still coming off. And I swam away from her. I was kind of pulled, and I swam away from her and got on a raft. One guy was on, we had a raft. I think we picked up 80 guys that night. And then, of course, we had a crash net, and we tied it to the raft, and so the guys would hang on to something. And, of course, as the days go on, the guys got sick or died from wounds they had. And I came through it pretty good. I got my whole side was burned on my left side, but other than that, I was okay. But the guys were hurt pretty bad.
A couple of things I want to ask you about there. One, do I understand correctly that was the very first night you were sleeping topside?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, my deck was three decks down, next to sick bay. My bunk was here, where it was a stack of three bunks, and I was on top bunk. The sick bay was right there. So.
And isn't that about where the torpedo hit?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it hit right, blew sick bay out of there.
If this were the night before,
yeah,
when you were sleeping down there, or if you hadn't decided to go topside that night, you wouldn't have made it out of there.
No, I don't know why. Well, because it's so hot.
Yeah.
And decided to sleep up on top of a steel deck rather than in my bunk. That was kind of stupid, but it saved my life. If I was in my bunk area, I would have been killed right there. I would never made it out.
And another thing I read about your experience, I think it might have been in Sarah Vladek and Lynn Vincent's book when they talk about your story, that before you abandoned ship, that I think it was Frenchie said to you, the ship's going down, and you couldn't believe it.
Yeah, Frenchie told me, you better get going, Bray. She's going down. I said, where is it going to go? Where is it going to go?
You had never considered that possibility.
Yeah.
That this beautiful ship could sink.
And at that point, we didn't know how bad she was hit, but she had taken two torpedoes, midship, one forward and one midship. But she was still upright. But then the water came and started listing right away. When I went in the water, she was on her side. Of course, when I hit the water, somebody drove me down about 30, 40 feet. It seemed like I was never going to get back up there.
Well, and when you did, I think you found it wasn't all just water, right? There's a lot of oil in the water.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was about like 4 inches. Well, I had oil in my eyes, my ears, everything. It was a ruptured oil tank or something when we got hit.
I'm just trying to imagine what goes through the mind of an 18-year-old who is woken up by a torpedo hitting his ship, who falls to the next deck, whose shoes go overboard, who then he's going overboard, and now you're in the water in the dark, not knowing what's going on. What in the world were you thinking?
I don't know. I thought the Navy did that to everybody.
You and hundreds of other sailors aboard the Indianapolis are watching that ship go down, and you're in the water. Looking back now, you know what you went through over the 4 or 5 days that followed. But at that point, as you grab onto this raft and other guys are coming alongside, did you guys think you were going to be rescued? Was there any talk of what's going to happen next?
No, we didn't. Of course, we're by ourselves, no escort. We wondered about that, but they said, well, your ship was so fast it didn't need an escort. We were the fastest ship in the fleet at the time. But that was kind of ridiculous, even. Most every ship had a destroyer with them, and we were by ourselves. And that was a big mistake, hindsight, you know.
And I'm guessing that you all would assume the ship was able to send out an SOS, a distress call.
Well, it would have, but CIC was hit, and it was just shut everything down. And we didn't even get an abandoned ship.
But you guys in the water don't know that.
No.
So the reality is you've sunk, and no one in the Navy knows about it.
No, we're by ourselves.
And this would be just the first night, really just the morning, till the sun came up. Did that feel like it was days or weeks or years? I mean, what did that feel like as a teenager going through that?
I don't know. I thought Navy did that to everybody.
Breaking you in.
Yeah. I don't know what my thoughts were. I know it was kind of I don't remember even getting scared when we got hit. It seemed like I knew what to do, but nobody ever told me what to do.
And you're injured. You're burned?
Yeah. My whole left side was, my clothes were gone. I didn't blister much. My arm was blistered, my left, but it was all on my left side. But that salt water didn't do it any good.
So how much pain were you in?
But it burns, you know, until it scabbed over and it was couple of days. The salt water was no fun to be in with open sores.
Well, especially when there are sharks in the vicinity too.
Yeah.
And I just want everybody to understand the situation. So you're burned, you're covered in oil,
You have no food, no water?
No, no. Well, the oil kind of protected you from the sun, because we were oiled from head to toe, in eyes and mouth, tongue. Still taste it to this day.
Oof.
It was, you didn't have enough sense to close your mouth when you hit the water. I drank about a half a quart of oil, I think. But then you start throwing up, and after that's over, you're okay. But being just out of boot camp, you know, didn't expect anything like that.
And you mentioned, you know, more time that goes by, more guys latch on to this raft with the net attached,
right, yeah,
floating there. Did you guys talk to each other much?
Well, I don't remember what we talked about, but you didn't know anybody. I went on board with 10 other guys, and they weren't in that group I was in. We got split up in the water, three groups, and we were the biggest group, I guess. I don't know how many guys, we ended up with 80 guys in our, but when we got picked up, there was 18 of us 5 days later.
Well, and the tragic reality of the Indianapolis is that even though 900 of the almost 1,200 survived the sinking, by the time you're picked up almost 5 days later, there's only 316 of you,
yeah,
still alive.
Yeah.
So we know that over those days, there are a lot of things that were happening to claim these lives. What was your first awareness that sharks were in the area?
Oh, the guys were getting hit. The guys that were bleeding, sharks were taking them first. But you weren't exempted. If you're on the outer edge of this group, I think we counted up the first morning, we were 80 of us. And then with this group, we had a crash net, you know what a floater net is?
Yeah.
We had one of those and a raft. We tied it together. They had something to hang on to because even with a Pecaut life jacket, it was only good for so many hours, you know.
I think it was like 3 days, right? 72 hours or something?
Something like that.
Yeah.
And you had to have somebody or something to hang on to because we were in the water for over 100 hours. So I don't know what kept me alive, but I came through it pretty good shot, except for the burns. That was okay. They were flash burns. They weren't deep burns.
Mm-hmm.
No, a lot of guys are a lot worse than me.
So you're 18 years old. You're burned. You're covered in oil. No food, no water. And now you're seeing other guys eaten by sharks right in front of your eyes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And the sharks had to come close to you, too.
Oh, so I got hit a couple times. Once I got bumped in the rib cage. I thought he had me that time. But the face is so pointed. He just bumped me to see if I was still alive or something. And swam off. But that was the closest it came. That was pretty, pretty scary. Because guys were getting hit all the time. If you're any kind of wound and you're bleeding, you're just shark bait, that's all. When they picked us up, I was sleeping and I'm hanging on to whatever it was. I was tired. I was in the water 4 days already.
And you hadn't had anything to eat or drink?
No.
Nothing?
Nothing.
How much weight did you lose?
35 pounds or less.
In 5 days?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you must not have had much strength left when they're trying to pick you up.
No, I couldn't even lift my arms out of the water. They were there for a long time.
Can you describe for us what that feels like with everything that you'd been through when you finally are put on that LCVP going back to the Bassett and you know for the first time you're actually going to live? What did that feel like?
Probably I was happy. It was just a miracle that anybody even found us.
USS Indianapolis survivor Harold Bray, who celebrated his 95th birthday this week and now has Father's Day to enjoy as well. It's time for our first break, but when this special Father's Day weekend edition of Hometown Heroes continues, a story that is more than just hard to believe, it almost seems impossible. So often I hear from listeners who say their dad never talked about what he did in World War II, so listening to other veterans' memories helped them imagine what it must have been like for dad. But what if you randomly met someone who served with your late father and could fill in some of those blanks? Stay tuned. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.